Please take your Bible and turn to Ecclesiastes, and this time to chapter 6. Ecclesiastes chapter 6. You can remember that the whole book of Ecclesiastes could be summarized in our church motto, which is delight in God to the glory of God. The message of Solomon in this book is to teach Christians to enjoy their life. It is broken into four sections that all funnels to that one grand conclusion. And maybe if you keep a finger there in chapter 6 and go to the very last verse of the book in chapter 12, we'll see, just to remind ourselves, that one grand conclusion that Solomon comes to at the end of his life and at the end of this piece of wisdom literature. He says in Ecclesiastes 12:13, "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God, keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil." And so man is to live his life in the fear of God, with the knowledge that he will stand before God in the day of judgment and he will give an account for all of his life. As Jesus said, every careless word. Does that ever frighten you? Every careless word will be brought to account. Well, we saw that the four sections of the book go something like this. The first point that Solomon makes is that the enjoyment of what is good in life is only possible for those who are in Christ, those who are in God, those who are with God. We find it in chapter 2, verse 24, that first conclusion. There's nothing better, or as we translated it, there's no good in man that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in the toil. There's no inherent good in a man that he can eat and drink and find enjoyment in it. That's Solomon's big point in this book. This also I saw is from the hand of God. Now, part of the curse is man will keep on gardening, but there will always be weeds. There will always be something wrong with everything. He will never find life in the things of this world. Unless, apart from God, verse 25, from apart from Him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases Him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, He's given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. So Solomon makes the point. The enjoyment of what is good is a gift of God. And God, in His grace, does not allow fallen men and women to enjoy what is good. Why? You tell me. Why is that a gracious thing for God to give no enjoyment to those who do not love Him? Grant? Yeah. It shows them the vanity of their life, doesn't it? The futility of their life. And gives them a reason. It points them to God, who will be the grand fulfillment. Very good. Now the second thing he says here is that life is nothing except futility and frustration until you embrace the sovereignty of God. If you believe that life is a series of chance events, if you believe that God is only partially in control, then you have no way of explaining all the things that happen in this world. Things like wickedness, things like why do men and animals all die and get buried? Why does envy drive everything? Why are some people lonely? How can we explain these things? And if we try to excuse God from these things, then we end up with a God who really can't defend any of His actions. But as we saw, He makes all things beautiful in their time. And God has a time for everything. A time to seek, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to cast away, a time to tear, a time to sow. God has appointed the times for all of these things. And until we embrace the sovereignty of God, life will be futility or frustration for us, because we'll not see these things as what we saw last time is our appointed lot. what God has done for us, where He has put us, the relationships He has put us in, the marriage He's put us in, the house that He's put us in, the job that He's put us in. These are all according to His lot, His appointment. And when we embrace His sovereignty, we see this and we can rejoice in it. The last few times we've been looking at Ecclesiastes, we were in the third section, which said a wise man is going to learn to look at life with God's wisdom. He'll focus on obeying God and enjoying the gifts that God sovereignly gives and takes away. And that's really the section that we find ourselves in tonight, beginning in chapter 6, verse 1. And that section runs all the way to chapter 8, verse 15, kind of in the middle of the end of the chapter there, which is the conclusion to this third big section where he says again, 8:15, "And I commend joy, for man has no good thing under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun." So man is to be joyful in the things that God has given him. He's to take joy in his job, take joy in his family, in his wife, in her husband. Find joy. Take these as our appointed lot and give praise to God for them. Now, the first thing that Solomon says in this third section here of the wise man will learn to look at life with God's wisdom. He'll focus on obeying God and on enjoying the gifts that God has given him, sovereignly given him. The first thing he says in this section might be categorized under this one big point. Prosperity is not always good. Prosperity is not necessarily good. Now we tend to think, and especially under the Old Covenant, we would think that where God prospers someone, that is a sign of God's blessing, of God's favor. What Solomon says is this: prosperity is not always a good thing. First of all, if you have great wealth, but no ability to find joy in it, it's not a good thing. Solomon says it's an evil. Look at it in chapter 6, verse 1. I'll read from verse 1 down to verse 6. "There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them. But a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. Do not all go to the one place?" Now let's unpack that a little bit. What is Solomon saying here? First thing he says is this: what I'm about to describe is a heavy weight. What do you suppose he means by that? "There's an evil that I've seen under the sun. It lies heavy on mankind." How would you describe that? Something that's oppressive. Good. And here's what is oppressive. A man has wealth, verse 2. He has possessions. He has honor, verse 3. He's got a big family, a really big family, 100 children. Not only that, he's got a long life, 2,000 years. 2,000 years. But if he has wealth, possessions, honor, a big family, a long life, and God does not give him the ability to find joy in those things, then it's evil. Maclean's magazine this week has an article on the Thompson family. You familiar with the Thompsons in Canada? Wealthiest family in Canada, ninth wealthiest family in the world or something like that. Listen to this description. Theirs is a world where trust is elusive, motives are suspect, opportunists abound. Relationships are mediated by lawyers, litigation chisels away at personal relationships. Private lives are defined as exclusive property and confidentiality agreements. Art is purchased to sit in vaults, and paintings are held hostage in marital disputes. Homes are collected in clusters as if in a monopoly game. Lawyers shred diaries. Nannies follow dress codes down to what colors are permitted in which seasons. A father sits in a room among divorce lawyers, refusing to look at his newborn just feet away. In a culture obsessed with money, the Thompsons illustrate that wealth is not reflexively synonymous with power and happiness. It also can summon a sense of helplessness. To quote David Thompson, "Gothic doesn't even begin to describe it," says a man close to the family. "You have no idea." Wealthiest people in our country. You have no relationships. Thompsons live in Rosedale. It's not on, what's that one? Prince, what's it called? Bridal Path? They're not on Bridal Path. There's some other road on there. What is it? I don't know. They're not your customers? But here, they're buying up homes. Just keep buying up homes to just keep everybody away. So massive. This bought one 2 weeks ago. $5.2 million. Nice big home. And you buy that home and then you leave it empty. Keep people away. Great wealth. Huge wealth. Prosperity, honor, Thompson Hall, named by the patriarch of the family, Roy Thompson Hall. Great honor, great wealth. Despair. So Solomon says, wealth, with no ability to enjoy it, it's an evil. So don't think that prosperity is always a good thing. Now we've seen that already, haven't we? What has Solomon told us so far about wealth? Can you think of some things? You work, 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 you get a massive fortune, you die, and then your rotten son comes along after you and spends it all. Right? What else? The more you have, the more mouths there suddenly are to feed, aren't they? What else? Nothing else? One bad venture and it's all gone, right? So, wealth isn't life. That's Solomon's point. In fact, he says, great prosperity, with no ability to find joy in it, you would have been better to have been stillborn. Which means, children, it's a sad thing, but some babies are born and then either die immediately or die shortly after death. And so Solomon says, that would have been better than to have massive wealth and no ability to find joy. The sinful nature ensures soul dissatisfaction. Have you noticed our culture's sad obsession with long life? People want to live long. So they work like a dog to get lots of money to eventually walk around as a pre-embalmed, prosthetically connected prune. And you do all that you can to extend just a few more years onto your life. And maybe it's wrong for me to say it. I'm turning 40 soon. I think I can say it, but I'm not really interested in that. I mean, when the body starts to cave, I say, let it go. Let me go to glory. I don't want to be connected to the dots, boy. I just I want to go and see the Lord and have a perfect body and be done with sin and be done with the evil in the world. There's balance. Didn't Paul write to the Philippians that part of me wants to go and be with the Lord, but part of me says it's necessary to be here, and I choose to be here because I need to minister to you. For me, to live is Christ, but to die is gain. Shocking what Paul says there. Remarkable. But he expresses what is the truth. And even though people walk around and try to become this thing that's never going to die, they're still going to die. 10 out of 10 people die. At best, they only prolong their frustration. They prolong their inability to find joy and delay their punishment in the day of judgment. So prosperity is not necessarily good. Solomon says it another way in verses 7 to 9. Look at there. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. Especially if you're me. 6'8", man. I got a lot of body to feed. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. What is Solomon saying here? Well, in many ways the same thing, but I would sum it up this way. An ability to work combined with an insatiable appetite. You have the ability to work, but you also have an appetite. I was about to make fun of pregnant mothers, but I won't. That have this appetite that never is satisfied. Solomon says this too is an evil. How's that? Well, you have an ability to work, but an insatiable appetite. He says the sight of the eyes is better than the wandering of the appetite. What do you suppose that means? Can you figure that one out? The sight of the eyes is better than the wandering of appetite. Good. There's that part of it that it always looks better until it's yours, right? And I wonder if part of what Solomon is saying here too is that what's in your sight? That apple in your sight. Wisdom says the apple in your table is better than the acres of apple trees you hope to have one day in your dreams. Your appetite is something that drives you, but you find no satisfaction. You never have enough apple trees. Better just to take joy in the apple that's sitting on your kitchen table. Pick that thing up, eat it, and enjoy it to the glory of God. The working man thinks that he's working for joy, right? If I can just get a little bit more, then I'll get a slightly bigger big screen television, high def. Or I'll get more memory for my computer, or a faster processor for the computer, or a nicer car, or this, or that. Everything improving on the past thing. I wonder if it would not be a good Christian discipline for us to pick something and just be satisfied with it for an extra long time. Like to look at your television and say, I'm going to stick with this TV until it dies. What? Or to look at your car. Darren's not here because he always says, no, you got to have new cars. I said, well, maybe you just need to look at your car and say, I'm going to stick with this car. Do I really need a new car? I realize there's arguments to and fro. I'm just throwing out some ideas. But wouldn't there be a benefit for us just to say, I'm going to be satisfied right here? I was shocked one time in meeting a lawyer in California. He had argued over 6 cases before the Supreme Court of the United States. Unheard of for one lawyer to argue so many cases before the Supreme Court. They were all religious liberty issues. And he had a not-for-profit organization where he would work for those who were needing lawyers that were Christians. He made a ton of money on much of his litigation. But when they were about in their 30s, he and his wife and his family said, "This will be our standard of living." And everything else God prospered them with, they gave away. And so God just kept prospering them. And he continues on that same path. So here's a guy who could be buying, you know, handmade suits, but he goes and pulls them off the rack. Could be driving the nicest of cars, but picks up used ones, drives those, and chooses to do it to the glory of God. I think there's wisdom there. God is the one who grants us the ability to enjoy things. All the toil of a man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. That's vanity, striving after wind, trying to grab the wind in your hand. Then Solomon goes on, verses 10 to 12. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? This is probably the most difficult little section in this section. Well, let me suggest to you what it means. Remember, the big point is that Solomon is saying prosperity is not always a good thing. Prosperity is not necessarily a good thing. First of all, if you have wealth with no ability to enjoy it, that's an evil. Secondly, if you have an ability to work with an insatiable appetite, that's an evil, because you'll just keep working and working, you'll never be satisfied. Thirdly, I think what Solomon says here is this. Intelligence with no final answers is an evil. I don't know a better way to say it than that. Let me try and explain what I believe Solomon is teaching us. Solomon says, that which exists has all been named. I do not think that what he is saying is that every species of insect... Oh, wait a second. Is that right? Or are insects, is that the species? I don't know. All you homeschooling parents, and you can't tell me the answer to this question? Yeah, you don't know either. Okay. So, I don't think what Solomon is saying is that every single insect has been named. We're discovering new insects, new flowers all the time, right? Just look carefully at what he writes here. Whatever has come to be has already been named. And it is known what man is, and that he's not able to dispute with one stronger than he. I think the idea of what Solomon says here is this. This present moment, what has come to be, this moment in time, is already named, if you like. It's already determined by God. You can't dispute that. You can't dispute it with one who is stronger than you, which I believe refers to God. So Solomon says, you think about it. You think about this moment in time. I've tried to do something. I've tried to make this day go a certain way, but now I find that I'm here, and it's not what I had planned. And this moment in time exists as it does because of all these various and numerous factors. This present moment, therefore, is determined not by me. I cannot control all the various influences and incremental decisions of all the different individuals all over the course of the world, all in one moment of time. This moment in time is not determined by me. It's determined by one stronger than me. I'm not able to dispute it. In fact, Solomon says, verse 11, the more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage? The more I dispute it, the more vain it becomes. The more I shake the angry fist at God and say, I don't like my lot. I don't like the way things have been brought together. I don't like the way that this moment in time exists. Then I am vain. The more I dispute, the more vain I become. And so, verse 12, Who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, while he passes like a shadow? And Solomon reflects back to man and says, you're like the little flower in the field that sprouts up in a day, blooms, and withers and dies. That's what your life is like. It's a vapor. It's just a moment in time. And you don't know what is good. You don't know what is right. But God knows what is good. And God knows what is right. And He has made all things beautiful in their time. And He's appointed all of those times. And although at the moment we may not see how all of these things integrate and fit together, we sing with joy hymns like, what God ordains is always good. His will abideth holy. God has determined it. We don't dispute with God, because that is vain. We don't know what the future holds. Who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? I know this moment in time, and I know at least partially everything that has preceded it in my lifetime. But I don't know what's going to happen 10 seconds from now, and neither do you. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Did you guess right? But the Lord knows. So prosperity is not always a good thing. By prosperity, if you have great wealth but no ability to enjoy it, that's an evil. If you have an ability to work, you're productive, you put your hands, some people have the Midas touch, everything they do just seems to work. But an insatiable appetite makes you think of a certain television personality who likes to say you're fired. If you have great intelligence, you can think about the issues of life and recognize that life is outside of your ultimate control. Great intelligence with no answers, it's an evil. So prosperity is not always good. And as we will see in about 3 weeks, adversity is not always evil. That's the flip side. And starts in verse 7. Well, that's enough for tonight. Let me ask you to improve upon the Word. What do you see in those scriptures that you can comment on and encourage us by? What does the Lord impress upon your heart tonight?